Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. This is the Point series by China Forum. In this series, we will have one-on-one discussions with top-level officials, diplomats, well-known entrepreneurs, academics, and media experts from both China and abroad to hear their fresh insights on important global issues.
Hello and welcome to the CISS podcast. I'm Dawei with CISS, Tsinghua University. As Trump 2.0 brings significant shifts to domestic and foreign policy, the future of China-US relations has been even more uncertain. In today's episode, we are honored to invite Ms. Susan Thornton, Senior Fellow at the Pao Tsai China Center of Yale Law School, former Acting Assistant Secretary for East Asian and the Pacific Affairs of the U.S. Department of State, to share her insight on the pressing issues facing China-U.S. relations, the complexities of bilateral cooperation, and how youth exchanges could shape a generational impact on global stability. Please stay tuned. Susan, it's really nice to have you here for our seventh forum on international security and strategy. So we spent a very busy day. So what's your takeaway or what's your impression of this discussion so far?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Professor Dawei, for inviting me again this year for this fantastic event. And it's, I think, the second or third time at least that I've been participating.
Yes.
And it's really a good gathering of people, and I always learn a lot from my colleagues there. For today's takeaway, you know, we discussed a lot of very difficult topics, I think. Changing
global order,
yeah. Power transition in the global system, U.S.-China relations, what's going on with kind of hotspots in the world. You know, I think, I mean, the watchword has to be uncertainty, which is something that's on, I think, everybody's lips and mind these days, not knowing kind of what's going to come of these big background transitions and also what will come in U.S.-China relations and in relations between the U.S. and many countries tomorrow because of the unpredictability of the policy process right now in Washington. So
U.S.-China relations, this is a very big topic. In your understanding, can you kind of describe current status, current situation between our two countries? I mean, use a few sentences in a simple way to describe it. Where are we and where are we heading to?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, if you look at the long arc of the trajectory over the last 45 years, we're at a pretty low point, I would say.
Yeah.
You know, it's really upsetting to me personally, having worked on this relationship for so long, to see the deterioration over the last 10 years. I think we were thinking that at the end of the Biden administration that things were stabilizing,
yes,
albeit
after the San Francisco
San Francisco summit meeting between President Biden and President Xi, things were stabilizing, albeit at a low level. But now we see again a lot of perturbations, a lot of volatility in the relationship, and it's very unclear kind of if we're going to be going up or down at this point. So I think it's hard for people to prepare. It's hard to know what issues to be concerned about, what to work on, etc. I try to remain optimistic, and you know, we were talking today a lot about what possible opportunities there could be for positive movement in the relationship. But all in all, I have to say I'm a bit worried about where we could be by the end of the next sort of year or two.
Yeah, I'm worrying that maybe there could be some kind of window of opportunity, but because I think both sides are moving very slowly, so probably we'll miss that window of opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems is that the Trump administration right now has a lot of issues on its plate that seem to be kind of more urgent or at least front burner in the headlines than the U.S.-China relationship. But we also know that the more time passes in U.S.-China relations without communication, without some kind of discussion about the framing of the relationship and what we want to get done, things can deteriorate very quickly without that.
Yeah, I think among all those issues that this Trump administration is facing right now, I think one of the outstanding one is fentanyl or anti-narcotics. And actually this evening during dinner, I think we also heard a presentation from one of the Chinese officials working in the Ministry of Public Security, working on the narcotic prevention. So from Chinese audience or from Chinese analyst perspective, sometimes we don't understand what does the U.S. side want from China. We think we have already done a lot of things. For example, after the San Francisco summit, our cooperation on fentanyl issue had been on a, I will say, a relatively constructive and also a very effective phase. But suddenly after January, you know, it deteriorated. Then two rounds of tariff have been imposed for this tariff. So we don't understand this logic. Can you explain it a little bit to us?
Well, I can try to clarify some areas. I'm not sure I can explain everything, but I have to say I've been surprised, pleasantly surprised, at the level of cooperation that's actually happening on the ground between the law enforcement agencies on these issues. A lot of things have changed and a lot of things have happened, starting back a number of years ago when China first listed fentanyl as a class of drugs. That was in about 2019, I think. Mm-hmm. Also decided to not ship fentanyl directly to the United States. So those were breakthroughs that were made earlier on in this process. Now, more recently, listing additional compounds of fentanyl, working with the Mexican drug authorities, working to prosecute these illegal precursor chemical producers, and working very closely with U.S. counterparts on exchanging evidence, this kind of thing. I think the U.S., of course, is always wanting more to be done.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem in law enforcement cooperation between the U.S. and China is when it gets to a political level,
yeah,
then it becomes very difficult to manage the cooperation. And I think that's what's happened, really, in this case. I mean, I think the U.S. would like to see China do more on kind of enforcement inside China.
Mm-hmm.
And this is partly because there is this, you know, just kind of caricature of China and the Chinese system in the U.S. that gives people the impression that because China is a centralized, top-down system with a lot of security services and police, that it must be very easy for them to enforce any lax operations. And if they're not doing it, it's because, you know, they're somehow dissing the United States. And I think that's a very oversimplified way of thinking about the Chinese system. So,
yeah.
But there is that misunderstanding, which adds to this problem, I think.
Yes, and also from our perspective, if we can, for example, continue our law enforcement cooperation, continue the old trajectory, maybe that will be more effective for the two sides to do, or at least on Chinese side to do more. But imposing tariffs, using those punitive measures, from China's perspective, we think this is kind of humiliation. Why you try to sanction China or impose tariff on China, then ask us to do something? And Chinese, I think we should not do anything under pressure. I think this is one of the problems we are facing.
Yeah, this is a normal problem in U.S.-China relations,
yes,
going way, way back. But it does seem to be ramping up these days because this seems to be a way that the Trump administration likes to pursue these issues. And you saw they did the same thing with Canada and Mexico, and
yeah,
Canada and Mexico both immediately got on the phone and mm-hmm. talked and put forward some compromise
yeah.
proposals that were able to get their tariffs reduced,
yeah,
where China doesn't want to make those kinds of moves. But on the other hand, I would say, you know, President Trump came into office saying he was going to put 60% tariffs on China, and so far only 20%. So maybe we should not complain too much
yeah.
about what's happened so
yeah.
far.
So talking about fentanyl, we all know that this is a serious problem in the United States. And I think from the perspective of ordinary Chinese, a lot of people know that American people and also as a whole, the society is facing a lot of challenges, not only this fentanyl issue, but others like social disparity, race issue, and other issues. So probably that's also one of the root causes that President Trump won the election for the second time. And also we are watching what is happening in the U.S., particularly after January inauguration. I mean, all those measures domestically taken by the Trump administration. We watch this with great interest and sometimes feel puzzled. So can you explain the logic of that to us? So what is happening? How do you view what is happening in the U.S.? Why that happened?
I know many Chinese have been making comments to me sort of indicating that this is some kind of comparison to the Chinese Cultural Revolution. You know, this is something that's quite actually shocking, I think, to many Americans, probably especially those that didn't vote for Donald Trump. But even in my conversations with my neighbors in the rural area where I live and other people who I know who are Trump voters are somewhat surprised by some of the things that are happening, especially because a lot of sort of transgressions on things like the judiciary and rule of law in the United States, sort of disregard for fundamental rights and disregard of judicial decisions are things that, you know, Americans think are kind of cutting right to the core of our sort of national founding values and identity. And so I think it's a question right now a lot of people are watching to see how far is this going to go. I think most Americans believe that, you know, the cuts to the federal government, while they may not be being done in the most kind of scientific way, are probably somewhat necessary because government becomes bloated and things tend to be hard to reform. And so maybe this is the way you have to go about it. So I don't think that's as much of a concern as these sort of more fundamental constitutional issues, disregard for Congress, disregard for the courts, and how far some of these things will be taken.
Yeah, thank you. And Susan, you worked in the State Department for a very long time. You are a veteran diplomat. So I'm, you know, analyst of the international relations. So I'm watching not only China-U.S. relations, but relations among a lot of countries. So sometimes I feel that now the political leaders are playing a very important role in our relationship. So against this backdrop, do you think diplomacy is something still useful, or I can say is still a very effective approach that we can try to stabilize the bilateral relations or improve the relationship and make safeguard our national interests? Is diplomacy still relevant? Basically, this is my question for you.
Yeah, this is quite a heartbreaking subject for me because I do see that it's becoming more and more difficult to make diplomacy work for the interests of a country in the way that it used to work. What does this have to do with? To some extent, it has to do with, I think, the diminishing authority of government in general, which is probably connected to the sort of fragmentation and atomization of societies. Modern societies have become so complicated, and the media environment, absolutely. I think that is very, very key. And it does lend itself to this also polarization in society, right? So all of that makes the space for diplomacy much more narrowed. You know, people have a lot of grievances, think they have all of the information when they don't always, but nevertheless they think they do. And it makes it hard for politicians and leaders in a country to make any compromises or take a stand on an issue or to lead and to try to move public opinion in a certain way because people think they have a lot of sources of information on their own now. And they won't change their mind. And so it's very, it's gotten harder to persuade. Yeah, it's gotten much harder to persuade people that something is in their interest if they don't believe it is. And that's sort of the foundation of diplomacy.
Yeah. So everybody seems to believe that they know the truth. And also too many people are eager to express themselves. So if there's a very crowded opinion forum, I will say, everywhere. And at the same time, we have very powerful political leaders all over the world. So they talk to each other, sometimes very effectively, sometimes maybe not. But I think it does not give a lot of room for diplomacy.
Yeah, I think that's right. We do have this kind of trend of having very big personality leaders who know their mind. Some of them have been in power for quite a long time.
Yeah.
If you're a leader that's been in power quite a long time, you think you already have seen everything and know how things work. And so you want to do the conversations yourself, maybe, or have your own input. Don't listen as much to outside input. This is a big theme now in the U.S. You know, we don't need to listen as much to expert advice.
Yeah.
You know, I think this is also a problem for diplomacy. You know, compromise is not a fashionable thing these days in America. It smacks of kind of weakness or not being tough enough.
Compromise, I think, is not welcomed everywhere now.
Probably, exactly. It used to be kind of a badge of honor to come up with a creative compromise.
Do you think that's an irreversible trend?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I don't know, but I hope not. I hope not, because, I mean, we won't solve any of these problems that we have today without a compromise. And I think the thing that, you know, I hear a lot of times from Chinese officials and leaders talking about, we need to have a win-win outcome. I mean, really, in order to solve problems, you're going to have to find a way to give each side some kind of a escape path, some kind of a way out, some kind of a face-saving way of selling their outcome to their side. And that's kind of a win-win. Yeah. You might not want to call it that, but that's what it is. So.
Yeah. Let me move to another, maybe happier topic.
Okay.
So now one of your hat is you are a senior fellow in the Pao Tsai Center at Yale's University. So actually, I know you and Professor Paul Gewirtz are co-teaching a course at Yale Law School on U.S.-China relations. And I was very pleased and honored to speak to your students last month in New Haven. And actually, I think my students in Tsinghua now is having online engagement with your students at Yale. So do you enjoy your life as a professor, as a teacher there? And also, what's the role of education in this diplomacy and foreign policy?
Yeah, well, thank you very much for mentioning the class. And I also have to thank you and your students for participating in this exercise. We're teaching a class called U.S.-China Diplomacy at Yale Law School. Many people ask, why should law students take a class on U.S.-China diplomacy? But actually, a lot of our students go into government and end up working on U.S.-China relations.
You produced a lot of presidents, senators.
Yes, exactly. J.D. Vance and a number of senators.
Yes.
And I think Elbridge Colby, who may or may not be confirmed for the Defense Department, also out of Yale Law School.
Yeah,
so.
I don't know that. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, a lot of them end up wanting to do policy work. And a lot of these issues end up being legal issues, too. Mm. So we, you know, go through kind of what the history is of U.S.-China relations, what are the issues, and now we're having them engage with students from Tsinghua to try to come up with a kind of a common program of consensus, if they can, on various issues that we should be working on between the two countries, and there are a lot of them. You know, I think this is really important for the students, especially growing up in this atmosphere that we talked about with this very polarizing media environment. And they're so certain a lot of the time about what they know. And so to see and feel this kind of, how does the other side look at questions? Why do people come at things with a different perspective, different history, different culture? And, you know, I think it's just very important for them to get that sense of both kind of cognitive empathy for the other side's position, but also the sense of kind of a human interaction, so they know when they're talking to someone who's a counterpart from another country that, you know, that person is not just a sort of a counterpart in a negotiation, but actually, you know, a real person with a family and a life. And that helps to sort of build, I think, some rapport and even some trust in these kinds of conversations. And I love my job working with the students. That's kind of, you're right, it's the happy place. And these young people are just so, I mean, like the students that you bring from your from your class to engage, they're just so energetic and dynamic. And I really do have a lot of hope in the future generations. I think we were talking today in our meeting upstairs with the senior scholars about sort of generational changes, and Zhang Baijiao was mentioning how every generation has a kind of a different experience and a different view of U.S.-China relations. And I do think these new and younger generation of students, you know, they come in with a kind of a fresh set of eyes on the relationship and maybe without the baggage and biases of of their seniors.
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the source of the happiness as a professor, teacher in university working with students is watching the growth of the students step by step, just like in our joint program. I think the students not only dispel some kind of misperception or misunderstanding to each other, I think they are also fighting against themselves, trying to ease or overcome some unnecessary concern. Sometimes, you know, they worry too much. Sometimes they demonize the other side. So I think through this kind of communication, talk to the students from the other side and also talk to the students and their own fellow classmates, I think they are growing and they become very mature students and in the future professional.
Yeah, I really liked during the first class session that we had, someone from your side said, well, I've never been to America, but I've been studying about the U.S., and now I feel like I actually have a U.S. friend that I can talk to and check things that I have as impression, check against reality. And I think that's very good.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Susan. I know this is a long day for you, and probably you still have suffering from jet lag. I should not keep you too late, but I want to thank you for not only joining this podcast, not only join our forum, but for your long-time support to our work at the center at Tsinghua, also your long-time support for constructive and stable China-U.S. relations. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, and I'd like to say the same thank you back to you. We've known each other now for, I guess, more than 20 years.
20 years,
and it's really been a great chance to work on this relationship and also to see you quite frequently over the years, and thank you for all the work that you've done as well.
Okay.
We have to keep up the good work.
Definitely.
We can't give up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Mr. Susan Thornton sharing her insights on opportunities and challenges in China-U.S. relations regarding anti-narcotic actions, diplomacy in modern society, and how youth exchanges can benefit China-U.S. relations. Thank you for listening, and please stay tuned for more of the CISS podcast.